محمد وآل محمد.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli forces are still hitting hospitals, killing the wounded, as well as medical staff. The same happens at UN schools, like Anwar's school that was just blown up, and refugee camps across Gaza, where large numbers of internally displaced Palestinians have taken shelter. Hell on Earth, Graveyard for Children, Catastrophic, and similar agonizing words are used by international humanitarian organizations to describe the situation in Gaza. Meanwhile, people around the world are crying out loud, asking for an end to the Israeli genocide, while blaming the United States for the plight of Palestinians. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this episode. Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, is joining us out of Bethlehem, New York. Also with us is Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist out of Damascus.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Now, Scott, beginning with you, you might know 80% of the Gaza population has been displaced based on official reports, and they're urgently in need of food and water just to survive. So aid is not reaching them properly with all the restrictions, you know, imposed by the Israeli regime. Who should pay the price of this collective punishment?
Well, Israel should pay the price, and the United States should pay the price. I mean, the bottom line is Israel's the nation implementing this policy, and the United States is the nation facilitating this policy. Let's be rest assured that Israel could not do what it's doing without the support of the United States. The international community is quite unified in demanding cessation of hostilities and the immediate implementation of a massive humanitarian assistance program for the Palestinians in Gaza, and then for a negotiated settlement that gives the Palestinian people what they have deserved for the past 75 plus years, that is a homeland of their own. Israel doesn't want this. This is the whole reason why this fighting is taking place. Hamas didn't act on October 7th, in a vacuum. It was the manifestation of 75 years of Israeli occupation, Israeli colonial administration, apartheid governance, where the Palestinians literally had no hope for a better future. And Hamas's action shook free the rust that had corroded the peace process. And this is what Israel fears, especially Israel governed by Benjamin Netanyahu and his far right-wing coalition. They have said they don't want a Palestinian homeland. They want a greater Israel, a biblical Israel that has no Palestinian presence. This is a fantasy devoid of reality, but Israel is willing to pursue this objective and kill as many Palestinians in the process.
Right, Vanessa, it's not only that they didn't want Palestinian homeland, that's true, but in addition to that, they didn't want any Palestinians either. I mean, as human beings, you remember all those, calling names, calling them animals and all that. And then we have some Palestinians who were just recently freed in this swap thing that happened recently, and they recount what they went through while in Israeli custody. They mostly complain about those humiliating, tortures that they suffered more than the physical ones. So I want to ask you where this kind of mentality and mindset emanate from. I mean, this feeling that some Israelis have, they feel superior to Palestinians.
Well, I mean, ever since the British, in reality, supported and incubated the Zionist colonialist settler project, this entity has been a death cult. If you look at what has happened since 1947, going into the Nakba, as Scott mentioned, this hasn't been going on for, since October the 7th. It's been going on actually since before 1948. There were already massacres being carried out against Palestinians in order to dispossess them of their land and their homes and their dignity way before 1947, when the UN carved up Palestine and gave more than 50% to the Zionist project before the U.S. Before the U.K. basically pretty much handed it over to the U.S. in later years to manage it. And so therefore what we see, I mean, we saw the recent pictures of civilians, children, women, that were basically taken out of refugee centers and places where they were taking shelter. They were stripped naked. And people have made, in my opinion, a very justified comparison to the Nazis in the way that the Zionists are treating Palestinians. It's complete humiliation. It's massacre of children. What is it now? Around 7,000 children. I mean, even saying that number is unimaginable. You know, we get almost inured to this creeping up of these numbers on a daily basis. We're flooded with images of children that have limbs missing, heads missing, that are burned, that are injured beyond belief, that have lost their entire family. And yet we see absolutely no compassion either from the Zionist regime or from its supporters. You know, when the UN representative from the U.S. can literally veto peace, that is the depth to which we've descended right now. The U.S. is basically vetoing peace. It's extraordinary.
Right. And Scott, Ukrainian President Zelensky is now visiting the U.S. now, is in Washington, is there to beg for, of course, more money and weapons to fight Russia. Why shouldn't the U.S. treat the Palestinians by the same token?
Because we don't care about the Palestinians. The Palestinians don't add anything to the national security framework of the United States. From the moment we got involved in this Arab-Israeli peace process dating back to Henry Kissinger, the Palestinians were an inconvenient reality. Richard Nixon, the president of the United States at the time, had encouraged Kissinger to seek a final solution, and that's a horrible term. I'll come up with a better one, a more lasting solution to the problem of Israeli-Arab relations, and in particular, Israel's relationship with the Palestinians. But Kissinger didn't do this. He chose to focus on Egypt and bettering relations between Egypt and Israel, and the Palestinians were left up to the Israelis to resolve. And that's been our posture ever since. We don't want to do anything that impedes our relationship with Israel, and the Palestinian people are such an impediment because Israel doesn't want a Palestinian state. And if we were to actually pursue a Palestinian state, it would put us at odds with your greatest regional ally. So this notion that the United States cares about the Palestinians, I am sickened to my stomach every time I hear the President of the United States, the Secretary of the United States, or any American official talk about how their heart is breaking for the Palestinian people, it is a lie. Because if their heart was breaking for the Palestinian people, they would do something for the Palestinian people, such as insist on a ceasefire. But we vetoed that at the United Nations.
Exactly. And Vanessa, the U.S. is still doing the same thing. It's constantly kept blocking all efforts at the U.N. Security Council, as you know, that aimed at stopping this carnage in Gaza. So if the Security Council is not the venue where countries could come up with these ideas to stop something like this Israeli savagery that's happening in Gaza, where should they be able to do this? Which international body?
Well, I think, you know, also an important point to make, not only is the U.S. vetoing peace, of course, it's supplying the bombs and the weapons that are being used to carry out the genocide against Palestinians, not only in Gaza, but also in West Bank, which is being largely ignored, of course. That's a quiet genocide and ethnic cleansing that's ongoing with U.S. support, while the more overt massacre of Palestinians in Gaza is ongoing. I think really what we are seeing is a shift in the balance of power, of course, and that is what is sending the U.S. and its policy instrument in the Middle East into a spin, which is, of course, the emergence of BRICS, the rise to power of Russia and China and their alliances in the region in particular. And I think, you know, the only other organization that has any potential to broker any kind or mediate any kind of peace, and we've seen President Putin recently speaking to Netanyahu, visiting the UAE and Saudi Arabia, et cetera, speaking to Iran and even to Hamas officials. And I think until, you know, there is an alternative, I think that's really the only alternative that I can see that has any potential to broker any kind of agreement, and also to legitimize the Palestinian resistance. But of course, what the U.S. is doing is totally delegitimizing the Palestinian resistance by nominating Hamas a terrorist organization, while in reality, Hamas is only one faction among the resistance movement. There's more than 17 factions in Gaza alone. And then, as I said before, Hamas is not in West Bank. There are multiple other resistance factions inside West Bank, and they're not even all Islamists. There are Christian factions that are against the Zionist oppression. There are even socialist communist factions like the PFLP that are against Zionist occupation, oppression, and apartheid. So, you know, at least the BRICS organization complex is legitimizing the resistance, which the West is simply not doing.
And of course, Netanyahu said that they are ready to start a war, you know, on the West Bank. They have been actually at war, but they are even eager to expand it further. And now, Scott, Antonio Guterres just admitted that the United Nations is unable to stop, to do anything and to stop this bloodshed in Gaza. Yeah, we had Egypt and Mauritania yesterday. They were pushing to hold this General Assembly meeting at the United Nations. Now the Security Council's efforts have failed, thanks to the U.S., of course, the veto there. So what can the U.N. General Assembly meeting do? You know, because resolution that's been invoked, 377A, asks for collective efforts by a number of countries, but it's non-binding.
It's non-binding, but understand this. It is the only forum outside of the Security Council that can authorize the use of military force. And frankly speaking, this is what has to happen. I'm a promoter of peace. I believe in peace, but I'm not anti-war when a cause is just, and the cause of the Palestinian people is just. The Security Council, through this 377 A resolution, can say that Israel must stop its genocide against the Palestinian people, that humanitarian aid must be brought in, and that if Israel opposes this, that the General Assembly authorizes military force to be used. Now, while this doesn't result in a Security Council Chapter 7 resolution, it provides all the legality necessary for any nation around Israel to use military force to achieve the goals and objectives of the United Nations. And so, you know, there is something, and what this would represent is that the entire world has turned not only on Israel, but the United States, that right. the world is sick and tired of America mm-hmm. stopping peace through its veto in the Security Council.
Vanessa, let's also have your take on this General Assembly meeting at the United Nations and what it could do in favor of Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as Scott said, there is potential. I think what is quite shocking for me as well is that there is absolutely no mandate for sanctions on Israel, while we've seen for decades now when the U.S. has an agenda for regime change or destabilization or resource grab or occupation, illegal occupation of territories, particularly in the Middle East. Of course, I'm here in Syria, which is effectively occupied by the United States from the north to the south on the eastern border, right? Mm. The immediate reaction from the US and the UK alliance and the EU is to place sanctions on a target nation. And yet, despite the fact that there are multiple experts, including very early on UN experts that wrote a very strong report basically calling what Israel is doing a genocide, a de facto genocide, we haven't seen any effort from the UN to pressure for sanctions on Israel. I mean, I'm not an expert on UN law, so I'm not quite sure how that would work. Maybe Scott could illuminate. But, you know, why has there been no calls for sanctions on Israel? That's a rhetorical question, largely, of course.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Scott, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, again, normally such a call would be made through the Security Council. The way the charter was envisioned is that the Security Council would take its responsibilities seriously. But as we've seen in the case of Israel, the United States will veto anything and everything that seeks to hold Israel to account.
Right.
So now we have this extraordinary measure. And it is extraordinary because what we're basically asking the General Assembly to do is acknowledge the failure of the Security Council and to take matters in their own hands. And normally the General Assembly is not the body to do this. It would be split, generally speaking, along political lines that reflect the Security Council. But here we have a situation where the entire world recognizes the genocide that's taking place. And so now the General Assembly has the potential to pass a resolution that can sanction Israel. It's not binding, meaning it doesn't mean nations have to do this, but it provides the legitimate authority for nations to begin sanctioning Israel and, if the General Assembly wants, to use military force against Israel.
Right. Now, Vanessa, this is a piece of advice from the Israeli Defense Minister to Palestinian resistance fighters, exactly quoting his words, "Surrender unconditionally or die." Now, with such a mindset on the part of Israeli officials, you know, one of them saying, why didn't you nuke Gaza? What kind of war is this? Just nuke them and just kill them all. So what do you see on the horizon for Palestinians? Where is this, in which direction is this moving?
Well, I mean, I think militarily, I was actually discussing that here in Syria today, and it'd be interesting again to get Scott's opinion But people here who are following the military situation obviously very closely, because Syria is one of the closest allies to Palestine and to Hezbollah in the northern occupied territories. The fact is that the IOF is losing the battle inside Gaza. It's basically burying itself in a quagmire. It's opened up various new entry points, both in the north and in the south. It's had to withdraw from various areas in the north today because of the intensity of the resistance attacks. Once they enter Gaza, of course, they're at the mercy of the resistance that can run rings around them. You know, these are not battle-hardened soldiers. They're used to bombing, using artillery. I mean, I've been in Gaza during the 2012 aggression. You're basically bombed from every single possible direction, from the sea, from the air, from the land, from helicopters, from drones. That's what they're used to. They're not used to on-the-ground fighting, right? And ultimately, the more soldiers that enter the territory, the harder then it is for Israel to basically bomb as they have been doing. The bombing will have to be a lot more discriminate and targeted. And the resistance then comes into its own, because it knows the territory, it's urban warfare, it knows the tunnels. We've already seen multiple times up-close contact combat where the IOF have been basically wiped out. And the casualty figures, I think, will be a lot higher than the 5,000 injured that the Israeli media is putting out, right, and the number of dead. So I think militarily, you know, I think we've still got a lot to come from the resistance. They've intimated that. They've said that they've held back on their tactics and on their strategy and that they're ready. And the thing is, we know from the fact that Hezbollah is maintaining this low-grade pressure in the north. Syria is opening up its territory for resistance factions to fire, for example, missiles at the occupied Golan territories. But they're all trying to contain that escalation that the U.S. and Israel, as its proxy, is looking for. But ultimately, we know that Nasrallah has already said they will enter the war more extensively when the Palestinian resistance tell them that they're struggling. But so far, they're not struggling.
Yeah, of course, let's not forget the Yemenis, they're also stopping ships destined for Israel, hurting the Israeli economy bad. Now, Scott, I want to ask you about Washington's ultimate and, of course, covert agenda for Palestine. Would the U.S. come to terms with this reality that Palestinians want to have their own country, their own state? They want to have East Al-Quds as their capital. They want to govern themselves?
Well, before the United States comes to grips with that, we have to come to grips with what Israel's going to look like. Vanessa is 100% correct. Israel has lost this war. They can't win it. I mean, no matter what they do, they can't win it. The Israeli Defense Force is incapable of defeating Hamas in Gaza. The reason why they're asking for Hamas's surrender is because they're desperate to bring an end to this conflict, because they know that the resistance is prevailing. Not only that, if Hezbollah enters this conflict from the north, Israel will lose northern Israel. They can't defend it. The Israeli economy is collapsing. Tens of thousands of people have been withdrawn from the north. The economy is crippled by what the Houthi are doing. Israel is going to be different. Netanyahu's time in office is finished. And, you know, the United States is going to have to come to grips with what Israel is, what Israel will be going forward. And then they can begin to craft a Palestinian solution. But for the United States, putting Palestine ahead of Israel is putting the cart before the horse. We have to get Israel reconfigured in a way that it will politically accept the potential of a Palestinian state.
Right. And Vanessa, one last question. The Iranian foreign minister told the Doha forum yesterday that there is only one thing that Tehran and Tel Aviv agree on, and that the two-state solution won't work. Of course, Tehran says that there should be only one state. Iran's offering a referendum to be held by Palestinians, both expatriates and Palestinians inside occupied territory, so that they can decide on their own what their future should look like. Your opinion?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the two-state solution for me has been dead in the water for a long time. And the one-state manifesto is what pretty much all the United Palestinian Resistance factions agree on, and the majority of the countries that have been supporting Palestinian resistance. Because, of course, what Israel has done is to undermine any opportunity for a two-state solution. Why? Because since the 70s under Ariel Sharon, they've basically been deliberately building the settlements to break up the West Bank into small partitioned cantons that can basically be separated and controlled. And that, of course, is what we're now seeing. They're destroying the bridges and the road structures and the connecting routes, right, while, of course, they're increasing the apartheid wall and they're looking at encroaching on the Jordan Valley, etc. So Israel has no interest in a two-state solution. So for me, in an ideal world, it has to be the dismantlement of the Zionist project, mm-hmm, and it has to be a return, basically, to the 48 borders,
right,
with the state of Palestine and Jews and Christians and Palestinians living in peace as they did before
West, yes,
Britain incubated the Zionist settler project.
All right, that's all the time we have for this show. Let me thank my guest, Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, from Bethlehem, New York, Venice Abili, independent journalist in Damascus.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, being truthful. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, has said, "He who has three things, these three things, should be counted a hypocrite, even if he performs the daily prayers, observes fasting, and thinks that he is a Muslim." What are those three things? The Prophet of Allah says, number one, breach of trust. Number two, lying. Number three, breach of promise. Well, generally, people in Muslim societies and communities just observe the ritualistic practices of, you know, others and get impressed, right? They just observe it, they just see it. For example, if somebody prays and fasts and shows that he's a Muslim, others trust him. But one essential criteria of trusting others is to check and see how truthful they are. If someone is a habitual liar, we should better stay away from such a person. Isn't that right? Because lying is a form of deception. Why would we expose ourselves to be a victim of deception? Hence, this is why in Islam, if somebody is a liar, we're not expected and we're not supposed to be looking at their seeming worships. You know, they're coming to the community center, they're coming to the masjid or a mosque, them volunteering on different fronts to, you know, for instance, funding an Islamic center or a masjid. These things are not the criteria. The criteria, the Islamic criteria of trusting someone is if they're truthful. And if they're not truthful, according to Prophet of Allah, he is a hypocrite. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing being truthful. Those who lie, those who deceive others, those who are treacherous are not loved by Allah. I think this is a very clear point that Islam has made through its instructions and through its teachings and guidelines. You know, anybody who deceives others intentionally and is treacherous and is a liar, Allah doesn't like and love such a person. Allah says in the Holy Quran in chapter 8, verse number 58, Surely Allah does not love the treacherous. Very clear, right? In fact, Allah sends His la'an on the liars. Allah says that blessings be away from the liars. Let me quote the verse of the Holy Quran to back this up. Chapter number 24, verse number 7. Allah says, "The curse of Allah be on him if he is one of the liars." Allah is very clearly sending a curse on somebody who is a liar, a habitual liar. Allah praises Prophet Ismail, the Prophet of Allah, in the Holy Quran. And one of the reasons for this praise, according to the Holy Quran, is that he was truthful. Allah says in the Quran, chapter 19, verse number 54, and mention Ismail in the book. Surely he was truthful in his promise, and he was an apostle, a prophet. So, you know, be truthful and be with the truthful. You notice that Allah even sets the criteria of being truthful for his own messenger, right? If, you know, Allah is praising them, he's bringing up the quality that they're truthful. What more clear sign do we need from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to be compelled that we be truthful in all our affairs of life?
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Erubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with the reporters.
The streets of the occupied West Bank are empty. Transportation is disrupted while institutions, banks, schools, ministries, businesses, and shops are closed as part of a global strike that was declared in protest of Israel's ongoing genocide on the Gaza Strip. Palestinian activists and grassroots organizations have called for the global strike to demand an immediate ceasefire as Israel continues its aggression on Gaza. The call for the strike here has been decided by the National and Islamic Forces, who also called for the Palestinians from all walks of life to rally on this day for the sake of their own people being slaughtered by Israel in Gaza.
The whole world is on strike today. This strike is unprecedented in history. This stresses that all the globe is with the Palestinians. This comprehensive strike that has paralyzed all aspects of life in the occupied territories means the failure of the official level and the Security Council and the international arena to put an end to the Israeli occupation and its aggression.
We believe that it is important to show that there is a solidarity with the Palestinian people and that the world, young people mainly, and the citizens of the world, if you like, if we can say so, are against this war or against this aggression against the Palestinian people and against this genocide.
The protests come only a few days after the United States vetoed the UN Security Council resolution that called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Protesters here say the strike is also a message to the U.S. administration that stands against the aspirations of the Palestinians. They believe the U.S. is not only preventing an end to this war, but also backing the occupying regime to go on with its genocidal war.
It's also a message to the American administration that has used the veto while 13 countries rejected this aggression. This veto by the American administration gives a green light to Israel to go on and escalate its massacre of our people in Gaza Strip.
For 66 days, the Israeli military continued its onslaught on the blockaded Gaza, killing some 18,000 Palestinians and wounding nearly 50,000, the majority of whom women and children. Ending the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip and declaring a permanent ceasefire are today's urgent calls, not only of the Palestinians here in the occupied territories, but also of the free people all over the globe. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Activists in Seoul, South Korea, continued their campaign to protest Israel's atrocities against Palestinians. As Israel's attacks on Gaza enters its third month, Tel Aviv's indiscriminate killing and illegal tactics are communicated to a growing audience.
Israeli media reported that Israeli forces have created a so-called massacre factory where they're intentionally targeting civilians using AI. And the U.S. is approving this. It's becoming clear that both the U.S. and Israel are war criminals in this genocide.
The killing of prominent Palestinians such as poet Rafat Al-Arir put more names and faces to Israel's crimes. Young people around the world are understanding that the diplomatic protection Israel receives from the United States in its UN Security Council veto costs lives.
When the UN vote concluded, I couldn't believe that they were really concerned about the loss of life. The United Nations should have called for a ceasefire. I am really disappointed that the UN seems like it wants world peace, but then says that such massacres are okay.
South Korea abstained from the most recent UN vote calling for a ceasefire. Still, as some Americans' criticism of Israel is muzzled, protesters in South Korea can say what they mean. As Israel continues its onslaught against the Palestinian people, the subject seems to have declined in prominence in the mainstream media around the globe. These demonstrators here, circling the Israeli embassy week in and week out, seek to remind people that the Israeli army is killing an innocent woman or child every few minutes. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iran has managed to foster a close relationship with Latin American nations, particularly those with a history of fighting imperialism and global hegemony led by the U.S., such as Cuba, Venezuela, and Bolivia. In recent years, Iran has managed to increase the scale and scope of its diplomatic and economic ties with Latin American nations. In this regard, Tehran has hosted the first edition of an international conference named 120 Years of Iran-Latin America Relations. The event was held at Tehran University. The organizers said the conference is aimed at reviewing the relations of Latin American countries with Iran and is considered an opportunity for researchers and political analysts to draw a new roadmap for communication and interaction in the future. Attending the event, the Iranian Culture and Islamic Guidance Minister said Iran and Latin American countries have a lot in common.
We seek to expand ties with Latin American nations. Definitely the U.S. and other hegemonic states are against any form of cooperation between like-minded countries. However, we believe that by boosting relations through cultural exchanges, our friendship will be long-lasting.
A number of Latin American ambassadors were present at the conference. They hailed the event as significant, calling for further expansion of ties.
They're marking the 120 years of Iran-Latin America relations is a very important event. The main challenge we're facing today is culture. Despite extended political and economic ties between Tehran and Latin American nations, cultural ties require further expansion.
On the sideline of the conference, we asked the new Brazilian ambassador to Iran about the significance of Iran's cooperation with Latin American countries, especially Brazil, through mechanisms such as BRICS.
There will be new mechanisms to facilitate the trade. And in this, if this happens, not only Brazil, but other Latin American countries will have much more opportunity to have trade with Brazil. Last week, I received a big delegation from Brazil to purchase urea fertilizers for Brazil. So to increase the imports from Iran and to, well, equilibrate a little more the economy. But I think with those businessmen in Brazil, with the high-level visits in the horizon, and with new inventions of trade without depending on the other countries, I think we will have lots of new opportunities in the future.
Despite the geographical distance and cultural differences, Iran's political and economic relations with Latin American countries have grown warmer in recent years.
The next edition of this cultural event will be hosted by Venezuela in 2024. Matia Pusyan, Tehran.
As Israeli bombs continue to shatter lives and limbs in Gaza, calls for them to stop continue to grow louder. More than 100,000 Britons in London have joined protesters in other European capitals to repeat the same demands.
Ceasefire, obviously, but obviously I want a political solution that means that everyone in the region can live with dignity.
This genocide has to stop. It's a genocidal war supported by a British government which sees no reality and no humanity.
Reality and humanity that these demonstrators are here to highlight. And as always, they are a mixed crowd. Muslims, Christians, people of no faith, and Jewish people such as Amy, who are saying, not in our name.
I reject this whole idea that Israel is the only safe space for Jews, because there is nothing safe about having a country that is illegally occupying another group of people who are already living there.
In addition to calling for an end to the bloodshed, the protesters here say they are outraged by the double standards, by the government's complicit silence in the massive atrocities that Israel is committing against the Palestinians, and also its refusal to listen to calls for a permanent ceasefire.
The rally comes hot on the heels of a UN Security Council vote on a humanitarian pause, which the US vetoed and the UK abstained from.
The fact that our government is one of only two that fails to vote for that is utterly, utterly shameful. The message of the British government at the moment to the Palestinian people is not enough of you have died.
What is the point of these protests if the leaders aren't listening, one might ask? But there are signs that public pressure is working.
We're seeing a shift in the position of European governments like France. Now, why are they shifting? It's not suddenly that Emmanuel Macron has woken up and found a conscience. He's been put under pressure by recognizing popular opinion in his country. We are already seeing cracks in the US position. Yes, they vetoed yesterday, but they're under pressure, and they're having to now say to Israel, you need to stop killing so many civilians. So we have to keep up the popular pressure, and we have to do the same in the UK.
Whether or not governments are listening to their people, without a permanent ceasefire, mass Palestine solidarity demonstrations such as this one will become a common sight in Western capitals. Saeed Pourreza, London.
On Saturday, a conference dubbed the Gaza Strip Out of the War took place in the auditorium of the Spin Time Labs, a large squat in the center of the Italian capital. The initiative, attended by a number of authoritative speakers and representatives of the Palestinian community in Italy, aimed at stressing how Western countries should assume responsibilities for the ongoing massacre of civilians in the Gaza Strip. Some speakers denounced how they are often censored by mainstream media for calling for peace in Gaza.
Unfortunately, our mainstream media follow the line dictated by the U.S. and by NATO. As a consequence, all peace efforts, all attempts to stop the war, are concealed. Most surveys show that the majority of the Italians are against fueling wars. Today, we're trying to give voice to these calls.
Conference speakers also condemned the United States for vetoing a UN resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and supporting Israel's aggression that has killed more than 17,000 Palestinians, most of whom are women and children, injuring at least 46,000 others in just 2 months of conflict.
This way, the U.S. continues to back Israel's extermination of Palestinians with the goal to drive our people out of Gaza towards Egypt, and after that, to drive our people out of the West Bank towards Jordan. Israel is the watchdog of the colonialist Western Empire in the Middle East, period.
The remaining 13 of the 15 current members of the United Nations Security Council voted in favor of the resolution put forward by the United Arab Emirates and co-sponsored by 100 other countries, while the United Kingdom abstained. The role of the European Union in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was also discussed at the conference. So far, EU's political leaders have been mostly speaking with one voice, backing Netanyahu and continuously reaffirming that Israel has the right to defend itself without any reference to the fact that Tel Aviv is an occupying force which is perpetrating crimes against humanity in Gaza on a daily basis.
Unfortunately, the EU has lost its status as a significant player. When a major war breaks out, all vassal entities tend to line up with the hegemony. The EU today overlooks the interests of its people and has given up its role of impartial mediator in any future peace process in order to accommodate US requests.
The Rome conference ended with a focus on the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have intensified their attacks there. Max Civili, Rome.
Signaling the dawn of a new era of enhanced cooperation. Less than 6 months after the Iranian president's historic trip to Damascus, Syria's prime minister is in Tehran with a high-ranking delegation for a three-day visit that will include meetings with Iran's president, the parliament speaker, and the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, all in line with the implementation of bilateral agreements signed during President Raisi's visit to Syria back in May. The Syrian prime minister signed six agreements with Iran's vice president Mohammad Mokhber that will pave the way for taking practical measures to boost cooperation based on the bilateral agreements.
Strengthening ties with Syria is among Iran's strategies that leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has always emphasized, and Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has also pursued. We are determined to broaden economic cooperation with Syria. Our main priority is peace and security in the region and the independence and welfare of the Syrian people.
Both Iran and Syria are now looking forward to strengthen ties in various areas, including trade, oil and energy, engineering, housing, communications and technology, as well as tourism and pilgrimage to holy sites. In this regard, developing transportation routes between the two countries has been one of the major achievements of the top Syrian official's trip to Tehran.
Our countries have deep-rooted historical and strategic ties, and the Syrian nation will never forget the Iranian government and people's support at times of need. Iran can play a significant role in the reconstruction of Syria, and we consider Iran a major partner in this process.
The visit comes as the Iran-Syria Joint Economic Commission is underway in Tehran, holding its 15th round of meetings, which the Syrian prime minister has attended in order to give the go-ahead for implementing bilateral trade agreements, most notably setting up a free trade zone and removing trade tariffs based on the free trade deal between Tehran and Damascus. With the Syrian prime minister's trip to Tehran and the implementation of bilateral agreements, Iran and Syria are now closer than ever, entering a new era of strengthened ties and enhanced cooperation. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The streets of the Yemeni capital were once again the scene of a pro-Palestinian protest, condemning the 2 months of Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. Protesters shouted anti-US and Israeli slogans and denounced all those who are supporting the continuous Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip.
No matter how many people betray the people of Palestine, and no matter how many presidents and governments side with the Israeli regime, the people of Yemen are ready to support Palestine with money, weapons, and we are also ready to fight alongside our Palestinian brothers.
Prominent Ansarullah official Muhammad Ali al-Houthi also slammed the Arab and Islamic world's reluctance to take meaningful actions against Israel to save the lives of Gazans.
The Arab and Islamic world is outraged with what they are seeing in Palestine. We continue to watch the sad and depressing footage coming out of Palestine, but we need to take more actions in every aspect. As the leader of the revolution has said, we need to mobilize more in protesting in our media coverage and also militarily.
Muhammad Ali also addressed U.S. latest plan to form a NATO-like coalition force to protect the Red Sea.
Today, America is calling for the formation of a big coalition which should also include Arab regimes for the protection of the Red Sea. However, we tell those who are thinking about protecting the Red Sea to first protect the Rafah borders before sending your armies against your brothers.
For the time being, Yemen's armed forces will continue to target Israel with drones and ballistic missiles. This in addition to the targeting of any ships linked to the Israeli regime attempting to cross Yemen's Bab al-Mandeb Strait.
The Yemeni armed forces are calling on residents in occupied Palestine to evacuate all areas near Israeli military sites because these are considered legit military targets as long as the regime's onslaught continues on the besieged Gaza Strip. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
In the limelight.
A human rights group has said the Zionist regime's military is committing horrific crimes against civilians in Gaza. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor has called for an urgent international investigation into field executions, torture, and threats of rape against Palestinians by the Zionist regime's ground forces in Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Israeli regime military is committing horrific crimes against civilians in Gaza," a human rights group has said recently. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor has called for an urgent international investigation into field executions, torture and threats of rape against Palestinians by Israeli ground forces in Gaza. Palestinians kidnapped in their homes and later released told the Geneva-based group that they were stripped naked and attacked with machine guns, electric cables and cold water. A 16-year-old boy told the Euromed Monitor that the Zionist regime forces stormed his family's home in Shaja'ia near Gaza City after they were besieged for a week without food or water. The rights group said he stated that over the past few days, Israeli forces killed everyone in his neighborhood who tried to leave their home, including his brother. The boy's family were gathered naked and handcuffed before being violently assaulted and beaten. Euromed Monitor added, the teen still does not know what happened to his mother and sisters, who were captured and kidnapped by the Israeli regime army. Euromed Monitor says that it has collected testimonies from people who witnessed field executions of unarmed civilians by the Zionist regime troops in Gaza City. A pregnant woman who was sheltering at a hospital in Deir al-Balah, central Gaza, told the group that an Israeli troop pointed his gun at her head and threatened to kill her, even though she had told him she was 5 months pregnant. More than 18,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed in the Zionist regime's attacks since October 7th. Health Ministry spokesperson Ashraf Al-Ghudra said recently, the majority of those killed are women and children. The Zionist regime's military is meanwhile suffering significant losses at the hands of the Palestinian resistance. This includes a failed attempt to rescue an Israeli captive that reportedly resulted in the man's death, with the armed wing of Hamas publishing a video showing his body and the serious injury of two other troops. Abu Obaideh, the spokesperson for the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of resistance movement Hamas, said in a video published recently that the group's fighters completely destroyed or damaged 180 Israeli regime military vehicles in the 10 days after a temporary truce ended. He said that Israeli regime leaders' talk of eliminating the resistance is catered for domestic consumption and to satisfy the bloodthirsty right wing. Abu Obaideh said, the enemies are still receiving blows from us and our resistance, and what is coming is greater. The resistance spokesperson said that the Zionist regime's ground offensive has only achieved destruction and indiscriminate killing, adding that none of the remaining captives held in Gaza would be released except on Qassam's terms. Facing formidable resistance by Palestinian resistance fighters, the Zionist regime's military is meting out its wrath against civilians. The vast majority of Gaza's population of 2.3 million people has been displaced from their homes, and many are starving as the complete siege enters its third month. Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, said during the annual Doha Forum in Qatar recently that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system in Gaza. Recently, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that the ability of the UN to receive incoming aid has been significantly impaired. This was due to a shortage of trucks within Gaza, telecommunications blackouts, and the inability of staff to safely reach Rafah crossing due to the intensity of hostilities, according to OCHA. Limited aid distribution is taking place almost exclusively in Rafah in southern Gaza. UNOCHA added aid distribution in the rest of the Gaza Strip has largely stopped over the past few days due to the intensity of hostilities and restrictions of movement. The UN Secretary General said that the situation is fast deteriorating into a catastrophe with potentially irreversible implications for Palestinians as a whole and for peace and security in the region. He warned of a breakdown of public order and the spread of epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. Thinning out the Gazan population and pushing Palestinians out of Gaza to Egypt, the Israeli War Cabinet's apparent strategic objectives are bearing out on the ground. Recently, Philippe Lazzarini, the head of the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, warned that the developments we are witnessing point to attempts to move Palestinians into Egypt, regardless of whether they stay there or are resettled elsewhere. He added that the decimation of northern Gaza and the displacement of millions of Gazans to the south is the first stage of such a scenario, and it is already complete. Lazzarini said the next stage is underway, forcing people out of the urban center in Khan Yunis and closer to the Egyptian border. Carl Skou, the World Food Programme's deputy executive director, said recently after a visit to Gaza that the UN's largest humanitarian aid agency is unable to fulfill its mandate. Skou said, "With just a fraction of the needed food supplies coming in, a fatal absence of fuel, interruptions to communication systems, and no security for our staff or for the people we serve at food distributions, we cannot do our job."